Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific Daylight Time. If you hear a lot of ambient noise behind me, it is because I'm not in my regular studio. I'm actually sitting in a coffee shop, you know, like a Starbucks type coffee shop. And nobody else here knows what I'm doing. They don't, at least at this point, they don't know I'm broadcasting. They might think it's strange that I'm sitting in the corner with headphones on with a microphone and looking at a computer screen. But, you know, one of the beauties of the modern technology is that I can do this show as I usually do from my home, from my living room, or I can do it from a coffee shop as long as there's internet access. And that's what I'm doing right now. Now, the reason I'm doing that is because I'm in Oregon, and tonight I will be speaking in McMinnville, Oregon. And tomorrow night I'll be speaking right outside, right across the border in Washington, near Portland. I'll be speaking in Camas, Washington. If you're listening, please excuse the noise. You'll hear the coffee makers going and the telephone ringing and the music playing in the background. That's not our theme music. That's the theme ambient music of the coffee shop that I'm sitting in. But we will operate, as always, taking your calls today. If you have a question about the Bible or about Christianity, I'll be glad to take your call. As usual, the number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And our first caller today is Rashad, who's calling from Elmont, New York. Rashad, welcome to the Narrow Path, and thanks for calling.
You're welcome, Steve.
Hey, Rashad.
How are you? Hello?
Good to hear from you.
Yeah, good. Thank you. Thank
yeah,
you.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Mm-hmm.
I have two questions relating to marriage. The first question being, I read your article on marriage on your website, and you mentioned polygamous relationships where the person becomes a believer. Now, in situations like that, how do you view relations going as far as the man having sex with his wife, so wife? Do you think he should only have sex with his first wife or continue to have sex with all of them?
I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure I understand your question here. You're responding to something I said in my article, What is Marriage?
Yeah,
what is the point you're responding to?
Yeah, the question is, in the case of a person who's a polygamist, a man, the man who's married to like several wives, say he's married to three wives.
Okay, gotcha, okay.
And he becomes a
okay,
believer,
yeah,
right?
Okay, my position is, yeah, I'll give it to you. There's a little bit of a delay on our line here, owing to the fact that my equipment is working through the cellular system rather than the internet lines right now. And that means that it's probably bouncing off a satellite between you and me, and it takes about a second. But, what you're talking about is a case, let us say, where a man who is a Muslim in a Muslim country or a tribal chieftain in an African jungle tribe or something, let's say that man has four wives or eight wives or something like that, and then he becomes a Christian. What does he do then? Now, in my opinion, he just keeps his wives and he continues to be married to them all. But that doesn't mean that polygamy is an okay mode of marriage. It just means that there's no place in the Bible that says that a man would have to divorce his wives, which he had legitimately taken. Although the Bible does indicate that a monogamous marriage is the norm for Christians, it never actually forbids polygamy in such a way that it would require that a man who's already got these wives would have to divorce all of them except one. So I believe that he would just simply keep them as legitimate wives. But he should take no more. And that a person who's a Christian before they have more than one wife should never take more than one. A person who's already a Christian should never consider taking additional wives besides one. But a man who's already got them before he was a Christian, he has obligations. He's made commitments to them. A Christian is required to keep his commitments. And we see, of course, in the Old Testament that quite a few of the Old Testament characters had multiple wives, and this was never considered to be something that was, an abomination. It was not the norm, and Christians should be seeking to follow the norms of God's plan. God's plan is for there to be one man, one woman. But where there were multiple wives, it was never considered to be adultery, as we might consider it. I mean, in our country, if a man was a bigamist or a polygamist, had several wives, we would tend to refer to him as an adulterer. In the Bible, a person with multiple wives was not considered to be committing adultery, unless he, of course, had sex with someone who was someone else's wife. But anyway, that would be my answer to that question.
Yes. Well, in a case like that, it would be okay for him to have relations with other than just his first wife.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, if he has multiple legitimate wives, then I would think that he should have relations with all of them. In fact, the Bible forbids him to stop doing so. You know, over in Exodus, I think it's in chapter 22. I have to turn there. It talks about a man taking additional wives, and it says that as he takes additional wives, he must not diminish the sexual privileges of the earlier wives. Now, let me see if I can find that very quickly. I'm not sure if I can or not. It's in Exodus chapter 21 or 22, and I don't see it just off the top of my head here, but it's in those early chapters after the giving of the Ten Commandments, where it's obvious that God does not consider that it was adultery, because he's already said, you shall not commit adultery. But now he tells them, if they take additional wives, they should not diminish the clothing and the support and the sexual privileges of the ones they already had. I'm just as I'm sitting here glancing at my Bible, I don't see the passage, so I've seen it recently. And so it is somewhere in the, let's see here. Okay. Yeah. Well, no, that's not it, but it's right around there. Anyway, I think it's in chapter 22 of Exodus. Of course, while I'm on the air, I can't talk to you and scan and think. I'm not that multitasking. But so anyway, yeah, the law itself would indicate that a man who took multiple wives has got to, give the normal privileges of a wife to all of them.
All right. All right.
But he shouldn't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well. Yeah. Yeah. But what was I going to say? The second question is, kind of related, but not really. The second question is basically, how in today's society, we have people who think, I'm born the, they're fully male or they're fully female. They say, I'm born the wrong sex. Let me go get surgery and become the other sex. Now, if that person married somebody, but they don't say, I used to be, I was a man. They physically look like a woman outside, but they're a man, and they marry somebody, but they don't let the person know that they used to be, male, and say it comes out in the marriage later on, and they find out, the other person finds out. Would that, and that person get to end the divorce? How does God do that?
I would think so. I think that marriage would have to be brought to an end. Yeah, because it was entered into under terms of fraud. I mean, if somebody was pretending to be a woman, but they were really a man who'd had a sex change, and they married some man on the pretense that they were a woman, then that's fraudulent. And I would say that the man who had entered the marriage would have reason to say that the contract is not legitimate because he was misled in that way. And because continuing the relationship, I think, would be wrong. Because the person who's had the sex change, the male who's had the female organ added, is still the same person inside as he was born a male. He is a male. And he's born a male by the equipment that he has when he's born. That's how you know a male from a female. And when they change their equipment, that doesn't change who they are. It just is to have a sex change is to rebel against God's choice. God chose to have you born a male or a female, and to say, I think God made a mistake, I'm going to fix it. Well, that's to say I know better than God about the way things should be, And that's rebellion against God, I believe. So, I mean, it's I don't think that relationship can be made to continue once it is known.
All right. All right. Yeah, because the reason I ask is, like, you know, I watch a lot of media news and such, and there's situations like that that come up in life.
Yeah. Well, see, here's the thing.
Oh, yeah.
Both Pharaoh and Abimelech took Sarah into their harem, thinking she was a single woman. But when they found out she was married, they realized they couldn't continue the relationship because she had come to them on fraudulent grounds. She had represented herself as a single woman, but when they found out she was really married, they realized that the marriage was not legitimate, and so they ended it. And I think it'd be the same way if a person married a transsexual, not knowing it, and was, you know, the marriage was entered into on fraudulent grounds and it was not legitimate, it should be ended also.
Yeah, I believe that.
Okay,
too.
Okay, Rashad.
So,
yeah, good talking to you.
Thank you. God bless.
Bye now. God bless you too. We're going to talk next to Jim calling from Salinas, California. Jim, welcome to the Narrow Path. Good to hear from you again.
Good to hear from you. And how is the weather up there in Oregon today?
It's overcast.
So. It's supposed to be raining down to around Ukiah area here, but we're in the sunshine down here in Salinas.
Of course. Yeah, so what's up today, Jim?
Well, being
besides weather,
I wanted to talk about the subject of Good Friday and Easter.
All right.
One thing. The notion that is popularly held that Jesus was 33 when he went to the cross actually derives from the fact that by Archbishop Usher's reckoning, which we still use to date this year as 2008, he was crucified in the year 33. The only problem is by that same reckoning, when Quirinius was governor of Syria, meaning the time that Jesus was born, according to Dr. Luke, the calendar would read B.C. 11. So he was actually more like 44 when he went to the cross. And that
there are some, there are some scholars who believe that Quirinius held the governorship of Syria twice, and that we only have solid documentation for the earlier time that you're mentioning, but that he might have held office again later on, but that could not be proven. You know, the assumption that Jesus was 33 or thereabouts when he was crucified, I don't think it's based entirely on Bishop Usher's calculations, because at least if I were to say that I believe Jesus was probably about 33 when he died, I would base it on entirely different things. For example, in Luke chapter 3, in verse 23, Luke tells us that Jesus was about 30 years old when he started his ministry. Okay, so it says about 30. He could have been 31 or 29 or something, but he's around 30. And then we have three different Passovers in the ministry of Jesus mentioned as Passovers. There's also another feast that is not identified. Some scholars think it too is a Passover in chapter 5, verse 1 of John. And if there were four Passovers, then, and Jesus died on the last of them, then Jesus' ministry was about 3.5 years and Passovers and so forth that are not mentioned, which is possible. It is possible that Jesus' ministry was longer and that we have a greatly abbreviated version of it. But all we can say is we can document about 32 years of his life or 33. He may have lived longer. But we don't have solid biblical ways of knowing that. And we don't know what year he died. I have always assumed he died around the year 30 A.D. because he began his ministry in the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar, which is what we would call about 26, 27 A.D. So Jesus began his ministry around 27 A.D. If he ministered for 3.5 years, which is a very common assumption, then he was crucified around 30 A.D., maybe 31.
A couple of things on that. Number one, I have suspected for years, ever since material from, among other people, Dr. Duane Spencer, the late great expositor pastor of Grace Bible Church, San Antonio, Texas, did his word keys on Christmas and on Calvary. I have suspected that the ministry of Jesus was probably in the teens of years, around 13, 14 years. I've also...
Well, there's nothing, I guess, to prevent that from being possible.
I've
that could be true, but we don't have any documentation for it.
I've also, on the basis of John chapter 8, reading the text in the Greek, when the Pharisees are criticizing Jesus when he says that Abraham rejoiced to see his day, the phrase that gets translated into English with a reference to 50 actually comes across with the tone of seeing you're a man in your 40s, which suggests...
Well, yeah, I mean, and Irenaeus, the church father Irenaeus said that Jesus lived to be about 50 before he was crucified. He may have based it on that very passage. The way it reads in our Bibles, it says you are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham? They may not have known his exact age, but they felt they were safe to say he was not yet 50. He could have been in his 40s, could have been in his 30s.
I think the Jewish ceremonies that he was involved in, including the Feast of Dedication, which is Hanukkah, which is around our Christmas celebration time, actually gets referenced exactly once in the entire set of Gospels, and that's John chapter 10.
That's right.
A time when Jesus makes the pronouncement, my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me, and I give
right.
them eternal life.
Right, and does that...
is a Hanukkah.
Does that have chronological significance?
But,
I mean, does that, Jim, we've got a bit of a delay here, but does that give some kind of chronological information about the age of Jesus at his death?
Well, I think John's gospel does, because of what the Pharisees and the leaders say to him several times in the dialogue. The suggestion is that he definitely has been around for more than a few Sabbaths. And you know, they're very familiar with who he is, and they don't want his message. And,
okay.
Of course...
Well, Jim, thanks... I actually need to take some more calls, but I hear your point. I mean, I think that kind of argument is a little bit subjective because one could look at the same data and not necessarily reach the same conclusions, but it is not impossible that you would be correct. I mean, he could have lived to be almost 50.
Yeah. The other interesting thing very quickly is that my English translation of Josephus fixes the calendar date, in agreement, by the way, with the way the calendar would have been in the year we call AD 33. That fixes the calendar date via the Roman calendar for the crucifixion at 1 April and the resurrection at 3 April.
Now, I'm not sure what you mean, because Josephus, of course, doesn't tell us the date of Jesus' resurrection or his crucifixion. You mean that he tells us the dates of the Passover in a given year, in 33 A.D.?
Yes.
Right, yeah, but we don't know if Jesus was crucified in 33 A.D. is our problem here. We don't know what year he was crucified.
Well, the year that he was crucified, Josephus doesn't give the number 33. But what he does do is the year he was crucified indicates that that particular Friday involved with the Passover was the 1st of April, by our reckoning, by the Roman calendar.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I've read everything Josephus says about Jesus, and I don't remember him giving the date of the crucifixion. I think he just mentions that he was crucified and that he was reported to be raised from the dead 3 days later. But anyway, that's fine, Jim. I've got to move along.
Okay. Well, have a very blessed Easter weekend, and I'm looking forward to seeing you back down here for the month ahead.
Yeah, I'll be back soon. Okay. God bless you. Good talking to you. All right, let's talk next to Craig, who's calling from Round Rock, Texas. We have a line open for you also if you'd like to call. Do you have a question about the Bible or about Christianity? Do you have a difference of opinion from the host and want to express that? Feel free to do so. We have time for you to do that, and lines open at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Craig, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
All right.
I have a question for you about John 6:37, kind of a Calvinist-type question. I really enjoyed listening to your messages on the website. I found them to be probably one of the best treatings on Calvinism that I've ever checked out, but I didn't remember you going over this particular passage. Maybe you did and I missed it, but I figured I'd call you rather than digging through all of it again. It says, all that the Father gives me will come to me, and the one who comes to me I will by no means cast out.
Yes.
So, what's the... To me, that seems like probably one of the more difficult passages from a Calvinist standpoint. I mean, from somebody...
You mean from a non-Calvinist standpoint?
Well, yeah, from a non-Calvinist standpoint as far as supporting their position.
Yeah. Well, Jesus said that all that the Father gives him will come to him, and that those who come to him he will not cast out. I don't know where the problem is unless we have certain assumptions about what he means by those that the Father has given him. I know that Calvinists believe that Jesus is referring to some category of people called the elect, which is essentially the elect of all ages, the elect of all time, is those that the Father has given him. However, he doesn't say that. He doesn't say the Father shall give me. He says all that the Father has given me will come to me, and or that all that he gives me,
right.
Present tense. And so the Father was giving him people. Now, who were those people that the Father was giving him? Well, if you look over at John 17 and verse 4, Jesus said to his Father, verse 8, John 17, 8, Jesus said, he's praying to his Father, he says, for I have given them your words, which you have given me, and they have received them. That's not the one. Okay, it's the one before that. I'm surprised it wasn't that verse to see. Okay, verse 6. Okay, I'm just glancing through here. John 17:6.
Okay.
Jesus said, I have manifested your name to the men whom you have given me out of the world. Okay? So the Father has given Jesus some people, right? That's the same people he talked about in chapter 6. And then he says about those people, they were yours, and you gave them to me, and they have kept your word. So that's John 17:6, after we've sorted through all the numbers there. What that means, apparently, is that there are people that the Father gave to Jesus. Before the Father gave them to Jesus, they were God's people already. They were yours, he said, and you gave them to me. We have to remember that when Jesus came, there were Jews who were believers in God, and there were Jews who were apostate. The ones who were believers, we call them the faithful remnant in Israel. They were God's people. Even before Jesus showed up, they were God's people. They were believers in God. They were faithful to the covenant that God had made. And when Jesus came, the Father sent those people to Jesus. the people who believed in the Father would, of course, come to Jesus. The ones who did not believe in the Father would not. And so when Jesus said in John 6, all that the Father has given to me will come to me, I believe he's referring to them. He's referring to those that were the Father's people, and the Father gave them to him.
Right. So this,
as he said in chapter 17, verse 6.
So this passage is basically saying, my first impression was, you know, as a defense against that, was that this talks about a group of people that the Father is giving the Son, but this makes no statement about how these people became the Father's in the first place. Whether or not they...
Well, that's right. Yeah, see, he doesn't... Right, Jesus doesn't say, these were the devil's people that you gave them to me, and now they're my people. Like, you know, like these were unbelievers, and now they're believers.
Right.
He's talking about people who were already believers. These are people like Lydia. In Acts chapter 16, it says that God opened Lydia's heart to listen to what Paul said about Jesus. But it says in the same verse that before God opened her heart, that she was a Jew who worshipped God. So she was a worshiper of God already before Paul, before God opened her heart to hear Paul. She was already one of the Jewish remnant. She was already one of the believing Jews who had faith in God, and therefore part of a very small remnant in Israel. And God, knowing that she was one of his, opened her heart to pay heed to what Paul said.
Right, it makes no
so that she'd come to Christ.
So you're saying it makes no statement at all about why.
Right, exactly.
Faith at all. Okay.
Well, that's right. Right. See, the Calvinist wants to say people will come to Christ because God puts faith in their heart. Well, that's not what Jesus said. Jesus says the ones that the Father gives him will come to him. But those that the Father gives him were already God's people. They already had faith. Because that's what Jesus said in John 17, 4, or 6.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, that's it. Enjoy your day.
Oh, okay. Well, hey, it's good to talk to you, brother.
You too. God bless you.
Bye now. Oh, God bless you. Okay, our lines have just cleared. We've had calls since the beginning of the program, but now we have about 24 minutes left, 25 minutes left, and all the calls are cleared, and the lines are open. So if you want to get through, this is a good time to do it. If you hear noise in the background here, that's because I'm not in my regular studio. I'm sitting in a coffee shop in Oregon, and I'm doing the program from here because that's where I happen to be at the time, showtime. Okay, you know, that's kind of nice. The equipment I have, I can just pull over at the side of the road. I can do it from a car. I can do it from anywhere. So I'm doing it in a noisy little coffee shop here right now. And the reason I'm in Oregon, for those of you who are in Oregon listening, or in Southern Washington, is that I'm speaking in Oregon and Southern Washington tonight and tomorrow. I'm speaking in McMinnville, Oregon tonight, and I'm speaking in Camas, Washington tomorrow night. And both of those meetings are at 7 o'clock. 7 o'clock in McMinnville tonight, 7 o'clock in Camas, Washington tomorrow night. And if you want want some information about where to find those meetings, well, I'll give you the names of the buildings we're in, but you can also find the exact addresses at our website if you'd like. We're meeting at the First Mennonite Church in McMinnville tonight at 7. It's the First Mennonite Church in McMinnville. And then tomorrow night, our meeting is held at the Calvary Community Church in Camas, Washington. That's Calvary Community Church in Camas, Washington. Now, I want you to know that if there's anything you don't like about what I say, don't blame those churches. They didn't invite me. We are actually renting or we've secured those buildings. They're not official meetings of those churches. This is just our groups. Once in a while, every 3 months, I come up here or so, and we have meetings for our listeners. And so the gathering will be made up of listeners to this program. If you're a listener, you can come too if you live nearby. McMinnville tonight at 7, Camas, Washington tomorrow night at 7. If you need the exact addresses, which you probably will, you can go to our website. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com and click on the link that says announcements. Okay, let me give you the phone number, then I'll take another call. If you want to call the program here today, we still have about 20-something minutes, and you can get through. The number is 1-800-438-5090. 1-800-438-5090. Our next caller is Christopher from Portland. Christopher, good to hear from you again.
Oh, yeah, always nice to talk to you, Steve. How are you doing today?
I'm okay. There will be a delay on our conversation, so after you stop speaking, there may be a second before I answer.
Yeah, I noticed that. I will run with it. Today, I thought I'd ask you about, because we do have Easter upon us, I thought I'd ask you about how you felt about pagan traditions and pagan influence in some of the Christian holidays, like Christmas and Easter in particular, come to mind. If those
yeah.
traditions bother you, or, you know, or what your take
somewhat.
Is.
Yeah, they do somewhat. The truth is that I don't really believe that the original Christians celebrated Christmas. And I don't think they celebrated Easter on an annual basis. I think they celebrated Easter on at least a weekly basis, every Sunday, and possibly every day. In other words, they did not have annual holidays in the first century church. At least there did not appear to have them. And I don't believe they are necessary. Now, I'm not myself a celebrant. I don't pay attention to special days. So this Sunday, although it is Resurrection Sunday, as some say, because it's the anniversary of Jesus' resurrection, is not different to me than any other Sunday or any other day, because Jesus is risen, and I celebrate that every day in my life. Now, as far as the pagan customs, I believe the pagan customs were added perhaps around the same time that the holidays began to be celebrated, and that would be, in all likelihood, around the time that Constantine converted the empire, or at least made Christianity respectable within the empire, and, of course, began to merge some of the pagan rituals with Christian ideas. And I don't think that was a good mix myself. I don't think that was really good. Mm. On the other hand, I do know Christians who refuse to celebrate Christmas or Easter because of these pagan rituals. And I'm not one of those. I don't refuse to celebrate Christmas or Easter. I just don't see them as different than any other days. They are, I mean, Christ was born, Christ is risen. Those are facts. I live my life day by day in the light of those realities. And I just don't see the Bible ever suggesting that we should take one day a year out to remember those things. But that's okay if people want to. As far as the pagan influences, go ahead.
You wouldn't be against it then.
Well, I'll tell you what I think. I think that the pagan practices that were added were not a good idea. I don't think that was a good idea. But I think that now, after all these centuries, they don't have the pagan associations they used to, and therefore I would think they're harmed when people bring a tree into the house at Christmas time, or when kids are looking for Easter eggs at Easter time. Of course, these have pagan origins, these practices, but at the same time, they don't have any pagan associations now. In everybody's mind now, they're associated with Easter and Christmas, which are Christian ideas. And so I'm thinking that although I would have liked it better if those things had never been introduced, I don't see them as the kind of thing that's going to get people into spiritual trouble if they observe them.
Okay, all right, fair enough. I think that's a sensible answer. I would expect that from you. I like that. And the painting's going well, by the way.
Good, I'm looking forward to seeing it. I hope you'll photograph it and email it to me.
I certainly will. You know,
and I possibly...
One question about that, portraying someone in agony and like that, it starts going towards, I feel like it's hard to portray him not being angry. Would he be angry, crucified, or is there more, just kind of an out of it?
No,
sadness,
he was not angry.
Okay.
He was angry he's not angry, he was sad, because remember when he was on the cross, he said, "Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing." So he was actually quite magnanimous toward those who crucified him.
Okay. All right. That'll work. I appreciate it.
Hey, am I going to see you at any of our meetings in the Portland area this weekend?
You know, I would like to work myself up to it. I do. I am a little intimidated, a little nervous, kind of like the sheep going into the lion's den.
I know, but no one will know you're an atheist unless you say so.
That's true. Yeah, I don't have I am an atheist shirt or anything like that. I'm very undercover.
That's right.
Very polite.
That's right. And you know
I think I'd be okay.
Right.
I'm still tossing it around.
Well, I'll tell you, Christopher, most of the people who come to the meetings are relative strangers to each other, and there's always a lot of people there that no one else knows there because they're there for the first time. So, I mean, you'd be able to stay anonymous pretty much. But I'd like to meet you.
I would like to meet you, you know, and if I don't make this, I promise I will come to one of your, I am very interested. I think you do an excellent job, and I like how it's very Bible-based, and it's very interesting. Christianity has been always very interesting to me, and you do a good show. I listen to some of the other shows, but your show is my favorite.
Well, sometime when you call, I'm going to ask you, what it is that makes you convinced that atheism is true. I hope that won't intimidate you, but it'd be fun to talk to you.
No, not at all. I'd like to open up and get a dialogue going. I think it's good for both of us.
I'd enjoy that.
Excellent. Well, you enjoy the rest of the day and enjoy Oregon.
Okay, you do the same.
All right. Goodbye now.
All right. Bye now. All right. Let's talk next to Caleb, who's calling from Corvallis, Oregon. Caleb, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thank you for calling us today.
Hi, Steve. Good to hear from you. I got a question for you. I got a friend who's a pastor of a messianic fellowship, and we're just talking about the Bible, how the New Testament, he feels that the New Testament was probably most likely written, most of it in Aramaic, and then translated to Greek. I wonder what you thought about that.
I don't believe there's any evidence of that. The Eastern Church has an Aramaic version of the New Testament, which they say was the original form of the New Testament, but there's no, I don't think there's any real good evidence that Aramaic was the original language it was written in. And it seems very unlikely, for example, that Paul would have written his letters in Aramaic. Aramaic was the language that the Jews spoke in Palestine, but very little of the New Testament was written to Jews in Palestine. Perhaps the book of Hebrews was. The Gospel of Matthew perhaps was. But apart from that, the books of the New Testament were written to people in the Roman provinces who were primarily Gentiles and would not know how to read Aramaic. It's amazing to suggest that, you know, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, which was written to Greeks, would be written in Aramaic, which they wouldn't be able to understand. So I know that not only Messianic people, not only people who believe in Messianic Judaism, but also people who, are Eastern Church people, they favor the Lamza translation of the New Testament, which is from the Aramaic. But I don't think that I think most of the books were not written in Aramaic originally. I think they were all written in Greek, actually.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that last thing you said?
Well, I think all of them except Matthew were written in Greek originally. And Matthew, as we have it, was probably written in Greek originally, but there was an earlier draft that Matthew wrote in Aramaic, according to Papias, the church father.
Uh-huh. And it's not likely that Paul would have written them in Aramaic and then translated them to Greek or anything like that, huh?
There's no reason why he would do that. I mean, he wrote his letters directly to the people he was writing to, and these were almost all Gentiles. In Gentile lands,
uh-huh.
Where Aramaic would not be spoken.
Yeah. Would there be a benefit to, looking at the Hebrew translations in the fact that you think they would have been translated the same time translated into Aramaic, in the same time frame, so you get a good, maybe even translation help to look at what the Hebrew words
I have to admit I'm having a hard time understanding you because of all the noise in your background. I know I've got noise in the background here too. But is it necessary to have that beeping in the background? What is that?
Sorry. Hang on a second. Sorry, I was putting my kid up and he opened the door, the car started. That's the car beeping. the beeping.
Okay, well. Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. What were you saying?
I was just wondering if looking at the translation, that do you think that those Hebrew translations, those Aramaic translations, were done in the first century, and if it would be helpful to look at those for translation understanding?
Well, it might be. I don't know when they were made. They could have been made in the late Well, I don't think they'd be made in the first century. They could have been made in the early second century, it seems to me. But I don't know if there's... I'm not an expert about the Aramaic version and, you know, what evidence there is for the time of its being written. But it was probably very early because, as I say, the Syriac churches, the Eastern churches, they do have an Aramaic New Testament, which I think some of the manuscripts, date back to the 3rd century.
Yeah. Yeah, very old. Okay, well, Steve, good to talk to you again. I'm Great Commission alumni.
Oh, yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. I didn't know you were in Corvallis until now, but it's good to hear from you again. How's your dad?
I haven't talked to him in about a year, so he's up in Northern Washington. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. But I think he's doing well. I think he's happy where he is.
Thanks for calling.
Oh yeah,
good.
I'm glad to call. I listen to your show probably almost every day, at least a bit of it almost every day. So it's nice to hear from you. Have a very good day and good meeting tonight.
Thank you, brother. Good talking to you. All right. Yeah, that's Caleb's father used to come and teach at the Great Commission School, and Caleb was a student there many, many years ago, where in McMinnville, where I was teaching. Back in the 90s. Let's talk to Jesse calling from Salinas, California next. Jesse, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
How are you, Steve?
I'm all right, thanks.
Good, good, good. My question is, you know the time that Jesus separated from his mother, Mary, and Joseph? He was at the temple listening to the teachers teach. Back then,
yes.
The teachers didn't know who was there listening to them, didn't they know that Jesus Christ was going to be the one teaching us the Word of God?
No, they didn't know that. They wouldn't have any way of knowing that at that time. He was just another 12-year-old kid in Jerusalem as far as they were concerned.
Oh. Yeah, because it amazes me sometimes when I read, you know, things in the Bible and sometimes I come across that and it's like, man, you know, he was born Jesus Christ.
Even when he was an adult.
Uh-huh. Nobody knew.
Yeah, even when he was an adult, many of them did not know that he was the Messiah.
Wow. It's pretty interesting, you know, that, you know, people didn't know, considering he came from Mary. Didn't they know Mary was the holy person? You know, considering...
No, they would have no way of knowing that. No. Mary was just another Jewish girl, as far as they were concerned. And Jesus was her son. And she had other sons, too.
Well,
yeah, see, Mary wasn't that special in Israel. She became special to the church because the church became worshipers of Christ. Mm-hmm. But those who did not worship Christ, and most Jews did not, they didn't see Mary as anyone special at all. And nor Jesus, really.
Just as another regular human being that came to the earth. You know.
Yeah, just another Jew.
Wow. Well, I appreciate you taking my call. And, you know.
Thanks, Jesse. Thank you for calling.
Okay, you have a happy Easter and a blessed one, too.
You too. God bless you, brother. All right, you're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We're going to talk next to Barbara, who's calling from Albany, Oregon. If you wonder about all the noise in the background here, I'm broadcasting from a coffee shop in Oregon, and you hear all the sound of the dirty cups being thrown into the dishwasher and all kinds of other noises going on. But I hope you can hear me well enough. The reason I'm in Oregon is because I'm speaking tonight in Oregon. Tonight I'll be in McMinnville, and tomorrow night in Camas, Washington. And if you'd like to come to those meetings, if you're in our Oregon audience, you can get information at our website as to where those are going to be. That is the exact address and all that. It's 7 o'clock tonight. It's going to be at the First Mennonite Church in McMinnville. And 7 o'clock tomorrow night is going to be at the Calvary Community Church in Camas, Washington. But if you want that, if you want to read that and get the addresses, our website has it. Our website is www.thenarrowpath.com. And you just click on the link that says Announcements there, and you'll find that information. Let's talk to Barbara from Albany, Oregon next. Barbara, thanks for waiting. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Thank you for taking my call, Steve. I was wondering why the churches haven't come out against the wars and the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan, and why they haven't come out and taken a position for peace, and also how, like in shock and awe, which was a horrifying thing to do to people, why, how they justify the thou shalt not kill. That's a big commandment. And I can take your answer off the air.
Well, the church is... Okay. Okay, that'd be fine. Thank
okay,
you, Barbara. all right. Now, why don't the churches take a stand against the war in Iraq? Well, I think you'll have to ask each church for themselves, because, I mean, some churches are against it, and some seem to be for it. And I can only guess why some would be for it. I would think it's because the information that they have heard about the war leads them to believe that this is something that is necessary to actually to bring peace. You know, you say the church should stand for peace. That is true. We should stand for peace. And I'm a believer in standing for peace. There are many who would say that in some situations, there is not peace there before the war. In other words, the war does not interrupt a peace, but the war interrupts a very unjust, tyrannical, evil situation. And war itself is evil, but sometimes they would say war brings about a more just peace afterward. Now, that has not happened in Iraq, but I think many people feel that that was what was intended when we went into Iraq, and some people feel that if we stay there long enough, maybe it'll still be possible. Obviously, there are fewer people who think that today than there were 5 years ago, and many Christians are realizing that maybe the war was not a good idea, and our staying there is not a good idea either. But that's not everyone has reached those same conclusions. You know, I would say, for example, many would say that when we went to war in World War II, I appreciate your call, Barbara. I hope that helps some. I've got problems with my computer. I want to put Vernon on the air, but for some reason my computer's frozen. So if my call screener could possibly put Vernon on the air, that would be helpful. And while I'm waiting for that to happen, can we get Vernon on there? I wonder if we've got a problem here. There we go. Okay. My computer's not working quite as it should right now. It may be unfrozen now. Vernon, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
You know what? I'm not hearing Vernon. Oh, there we go.
Gotcha. You hear me now?
Yes, I can now. Thank you. There's a bit of a delay.
All right. My question deals with Cain and Abel. After Cain killed Abel, and God cursed him and everything, and he said that my punishment is too great for me to bear because I'm going to be away from you, and Eve told him to go to the city and find him a wife. Now, if Cain and Abel are their first two children, how could he go find him a wife in the city? Or did Adam and Eve already procreate enough to have a town off in the distance for him to go get him a wife?
Well, okay, well, first of all, Eve didn't tell him to go to a city and find a wife. We never read of Eve again after after Cain kills Abel. We don't read of Eve anymore after that. But we do read of Cain going from the presence of the Lord, and he goes to the land of Nod, and there it says Cain knew his wife, which means he had relations with his wife and had children. It does not say that he got his wife there. He may have taken her with him into the land of Nod. And the land of Nod, the word Nod in Hebrew just means wandering. So it may be that that didn't really have that name before he went there, and it became known as the land of Nod because he was wandering around there. But he had a wife there, and that's your main question. Where did she come from? And the answer is that she came from Adam and Eve, just like everybody else. And we know that because the Bible says that when Eve was created, her name, Eve, was given to her because she's the mother of all living. So Eve was the mother of all living people. And the Bible says that all mankind was in Adam when he fell, so that all people came from Adam and Eve. Now, when Cain killed Abel, it is likely that Cain was about 130 years old, or at least that the event happened shortly before that time. And the reason for that is because Adam was 130 years old when Seth was born. And when Seth given me another son to replace Adam, whom Cain slew.
Was it slew or Shem?
Four there, too, just after that. But she didn't send Cain off. But she does mention that Seth was a replacement for Abel. And that being so, it would seem that Seth was the first son that was born to her after Abel died. Okay? Or else why would she see him as the replacement for Abel, unless Abel had recently been killed and now Seth replaced him? But here's the problem. Seth was born when Adam and Eve were 130 years old. And if that was shortly after Abel died, then Cain killed Abel when they were almost 130 years old, maybe 125, something like that. Now, in that time, before Cain sought a wife, Adam and Eve were having kids for 125 years. And they've no doubt had a lot of them. We do read in Genesis chapter 5 that they had sons and daughters. And so we should assume that when Cain took a wife, he just took one of his sisters to be a wife. And by the way, as strange as that would be in our day and age, that's not been strange in every culture. And it wasn't then, apparently. I'm going to have to leave it at that because I hear the music playing. But
yeah,
Erna, I hope that helps.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks for your call. God bless you. Yeah, it's good to hear from you. Well, you've been listening to The Narrow Path. The noise in the background is because I'm actually in a coffee shop doing the show today, but that's over now. I'll be in a quiet place Monday, my own studio at home. If you'd like to help us pay the bills, and they are radio bills, we pay the radio stations for the time, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633. Santa Cruz, California, 95063. If you want to go to our website, it's thenarrowpath.com. Lots of free resources there. Nothing for sale in this ministry, but everything's free. Hundreds of MP3 files. There's printed files. There's other stuff there, too. Just check it out. It's thenarrowpath.com. If you're interested in attending one of the meetings I'm teaching here in Oregon this weekend or anywhere else, the meetings are always listed at our website under announcements. That's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Easter weekend, and I hope to see some of you tonight. The rest of you, we'll talk on Monday. God bless. Bye-bye.
There is no substitute for income. Social Security will help with approximately one-third to one-half of your needs. The balance is up to you. Your pension, 401k, and IRAs will have to make up the difference. If you have insufficient income, you may have to move in with the kids or relatives or reduce your lifestyle. Only with planning can you avoid an income shortfall. For an appointment, call John Dieroff at 754-1744. That's John Dieroff, CLU, 754-1744. California license 0243-446. Throughout Scripture, the word door is symbolic of opportunity and decision. Now the word door has new meaning in Santa Cruz. It's the name of the area's newest Christian bookstore. The door is your source for the latest of Christian books, Bibles, and music. Plus, when you enter the door, you also find Christian gifts, cards, jewelry, and apparel. The door, open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 6, just a half a block beyond 41st Avenue at 3912 Portola Avenue. Or call 475-DOOR. That's 475-3667. The door, now open.
The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his